That's kind of one part where I've noticed when you change your interfaces, it can be really tedious because it just propagates and touches not just your source code, but now all of your tests usually have to be updated too. That's something that I like to focus on a little more during this like upfront stage, is try to think of what the interfaces will look like, just because getting those right is a big time saver and a pretty important part.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name's Sagachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with Matt Solomon. How's it going?
Well, excited to be here.
Excited to have you on. Just for some context, for the people that don't know you, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so as you said, my name is Matt. I first started getting into crypto around 2017, 2018. Left my old job to do it full-time around 2019. Wasn't really sure what I wanted to do yet. Was still kind of figuring it out. Eventually, I linked up with Ben DeFrancisco, who founded Scopelift, and we've been working together probably about 3.5 years now. It's like sometime in 2020. And we're at Scopelift, so we're like a smart contract development shop. We also do some front-end work, back-end work all over the space, and it's been a lot of fun.
And what were you doing at your previous job in the Web2 before you transitioned?
So I actually did not come from Web2. I was in aerospace before, so yeah. I did a lot. There's actually a good amount of people in crypto with aerospace backgrounds, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, so I was doing like some systems engineering work, which is kind of like, you know, designing your system, coming up with requirements analysis, stuff like that. And then some guidance navigation and control work, which is like, you know, the part I did a lot of was the navigation side. So you have all these different inputs from your sensors, and how do you get the best estimates for where you actually are using, you know, Kalman filtering and other techniques. So that was pretty fun. I did enjoy it, but eventually crypto took more of my interest.
And you know, coming from that kind of background, you know, these are like very large, complex systems, right? And, you know, working with multiple people, it's like a great kind of skill to bring into coding. So I guess having said that, you also maintain like Forge Standard.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Forge Standard Library. And, you know, it's quite big. So what kind of best practices did you keep from, you know, the aerospace kind of background, and also have brought onto, you know, the more programming background in Web3?
Yeah, good question. I guess I kind of have a couple of answers there. I guess the first one, unrelated to the big code-based part, but you've probably heard this before, which is how like smart contract development is more similar to, you know, hardware development or aerospace than it is like traditional Web2 because of the immutability. And so you want to make sure things are really safe and secure. And so coming from aerospace is kind of really nice there. It's very different than like the move fast and break things in Web2, but you have very clear-cut requirements that you have to design your system to, and there's all sorts of really stringent regulations and approval processes that you have to go through before any software can be certified and used as flight software. Tons of safety regulations there. And they're really, you know, hard to comply with, really expensive, but it is like a good mindset to carry over into crypto, which is just, you know, once things are deployed, it's hard to fix them. And so having that care in mind and that mindset, I think is really nice. And the second part around large code bases, we probably haven't been the best with this for Forge Standard, but documentation is just the biggest, you know, especially for new people coming into the code base, trying to find where things are, why things are the way they are. And then for users too, there's a lot of stuff in Forge Standard that people just don't know about, all sorts of like, you know, standard cheats, we call them, because they're not the native cheats from Forge. There's all sorts of like standard cheats that just aren't super well documented in the Forge book or the code base. And so the only way people kind of find them is by reading through the Forge Standard code, which I would encourage you to do. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Or, you know, from tweets or whenever people mention it. Yeah, so documentation is definitely one of the biggest there. especially with Force Center 2, since the library, we have to try to maintain compatibility for a wide range of Solidity versions. And so that comes with some of its own challenges, because we support back to version 6.2, which is where interface inheritance was introduced. So that was like a deliberate choice. And the compiler will output different warnings or different errors depending on the version. And we don't want people to get warnings from their dependencies. So there's an interesting like Solidity tricks and workarounds that myself and various other contributors have added to the code base, which are kind of fun to read through.
Mm-hmm. And what is really the process of, you know, if someone places, if you place an issue or someone places an issue and they want to contribute, what if someone else is also working on it and you make a PR? What is kind of the process or the standard to really submit a PR and have it confirmed?
Yeah. So a lot of people will just open PRs without having an issue beforehand. And for simple things, sometimes it's fine. For more complex things, there might end up being a lot of rework or pushback if, you know, for some reason that feature is not desirable. And so typically it's always better to start with an issue. I like trying to put, you know, a pretty clear, you know, quote spec, like doesn't have to be super formal, but what's the UX going to look like? How is it going to, you know, function and help people out, or what's the purpose of it? And that way everyone kind of aligns on the goals. And that way, once the PR is open, all you have to do is like review the code and you don't have to discuss the actual feature itself. It also helps, you know, prevent rework, which is nice. So people don't spend a couple hours implementing a feature to be told, you know, we don't want this because of X.
It's kind of like, you know, building a startup where if there's a feature that nobody wants, what's the point of working on it? So on that topic, how do you really prioritize what needs to be added or...
Yeah, I don't have like a great answer. I think it's kind of just like a feel I get just from, you know, being around for a while, doing a lot of development myself and kind of understanding what's something that would benefit a lot of people versus what's maybe too niche to include in Forge Standard. And we're trying to be careful about adding bloat. The more stuff there is in Forge Standard, the longer your tests are going to take to compile. And so compile times currently are kind of becoming like the performance bottleneck, especially with via IR, really large test files. So we're trying to be really deliberate about keeping Forge Standard's contribution to that as low as possible. And part of that includes what we want to start doing is migrating all of these, you know, standard cheats that we've talked about upstream into Forge. That way, you know, they can be written in Rust. They're included as part of the Forge binary. They don't need to be compiled by Solidity. And so that should help performance a little bit. And so these days, we're a lot more selective about adding additional cheats to Forge Standard if they're things that, you know, can easily be upstreamed as a native cheat code instead.
Yeah. So you mentioned basically how can you help as many people as possible? Like what do people actually need? And I guess when you first kind of got into, you know, maintaining, how did you really, you know, choose what that was? Was it more of like from a user perspective or from a developer's perspective of, oh, I think this is what people want?
So a lot of it is kind of historical. So DapTools was like the predecessor to Foundry. Same UX, but written in Haskell. And there was a lot of features that it lacked. And, you know, people who... I wasn't a heavy DapTools user, but I was using it a little bit and starting to use it more and more. Mm. And it became pretty apparent where the limitations were and what kind of things you had to work around all the time. So, like, one of the biggest, for example, was... the prank cheat code, which is the one you use to like impersonate an account, did not exist in DapTools. And so the way you'd have to write your tests is like with user contracts. So you write a contract, right? If you're writing an ERC-20 token, you write a contract Alice. And what that contract does is just have public methods to call every method on your token contract. And so that's how you had to interact with your code and write tests, which is really clunky. And so from the DapTools user experience, and, you know, from Hardhat having its impersonate account feature also, it was pretty apparent, like, okay, we know we need this prank cheat code. We also knew, like, people are often dealing with tokens and you need token balances. And so if you're using DapTools, you know, you'd have to fork mainnet, find someone with a large balance and transfer it away. Or you can calculate storage slots manually and set them directly. That's another thing. It's, like, super common. You see it in a lot of code bases. You always have to do it yourself. And so that's why Brock Elmore, who I think was on an episode earlier,
Yeah.
He wrote the standard storage library in Forge Standard, which is like where the deal ERC20 cheats come from. And so it's kind of just things like that. A lot of like historical use of things that were lacking in the predecessor, along with things that were common from writing tests and hard hat that we knew needed to be ported over.
Yeah, for sure. 100% agree. I think in a terms of, I'm just going to reference like a different kind of field of, you know, creating, you know, a startup where you're trying to get to the MVP state and you can't necessarily add these small features. It's more of like, what feature do people need? But maybe that feature is actually like quite big. I guess, how would you get to that first iteration of that big feature where people actually want to use it instead of, you know, the small one that nobody wants to use, and you have to keep on building these modular ones until you get to the big one where people actually use it? If you're trying to build like an MVP state for a startup, but the main kind of thing that people would want to use is this very big feature, how would you really get to that, you know, first iteration where people would use it?
Yeah, I think the answer is probably just try to figure out how to trim it down as much as possible. There's a lot of times there's like some subset or, you know, some smaller piece that would be useful on its own. And maybe not always. Maybe sometimes you do just have to figure out the quickest way to build this big feature and test it out. But if you can find some smaller subset, which is, you know, somewhat representative of what you're aiming towards, and use that at least to put it out there and test and get some feedback, that's usually super helpful. Mm-hmm. With Boundary, we knew feature parity with DappTools was the big thing, because we know there was a lot of DappTools users, like Maker was the big one. And getting that feature parity is kind of the first step if you want people to convert. Feature parity with Hardhat is also, you know, the other set there too, since Hardhat was the main test tool that people were using if they weren't using. Yeah, well, DappTools was pretty niche. So kind of feature parity with existing tools, which is a really big lift. And it did take quite a bit of time for the core team to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
It did move fast, so it might have only been a couple of months, but it definitely was a lot of work.
Oh, yeah, definitely. If you have like this giant code base, you have to basically mimic it. Otherwise, why would anybody use your one?
Exactly.
Yeah, it can be quite difficult. And how did you really go through that process of refactoring this into, you know, Rust?
So I wasn't super involved writing most of the code in the early days. I was following along closely and, you know, giving feedback on how things were working, testing it out, what should we add next, etc. I didn't know Rust at that time. I'm still, you know, learning Rust. I'm definitely not the best Rust developer, but I've been doing a lot more of it recently. And so, yeah, Georgios, Brock, and a couple others were kind of leading the drive there. They could probably give a better answer than I could. I know Revum was, well, actually, I think Sputnik maybe was the Rust EVM that was used originally. So not having to write the EVM, you know, saves a good amount of work. And then having DappTools as a template to base things on, I'm sure helped a lot too.
Yeah, the Forge standard is mostly focused on really UX interaction and, you know, how easy is it for a user to, you know, test, right?
Exactly. So there was a lot of cheat codes that, you know, DappTools and Forge had, such as, you know, reading slots directly and writing directly to slots. And there was certain solidity helpers that people would commonly write around those. And so that's kind of the inception of Forge standard is, you know, let's take all of these common utilities that people are writing, lump them all into the standard library and include that by default and expand the functionality that way. It is also kind of nice because Solidity is a lot more accessible to a lot of developers. And so when they have standard cheats or feature requests that they want, it's a lot easier for them to PR into Forge standard than to learn Rust.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Let's say someone wanted to contribute to, you know, one of these big kind of code bases. What would you recommend for them to do to kind of onboard into that?
Yeah, so I'll use Foundry as an example here because Forge and, you know, the rest of it and BuildChisel are pretty well, decently well documented in the repo from like a developer doc standpoint. And so I think in general for any repo is, you know, make sure you kind of have an understanding of the architecture and how it works from a high level. And that way you know which pieces you need to touch, where to put things and whatnot. And the maintainers are super helpful, especially with Forge. Like if you have something that you want to implement and you get stuck, you just open a draft PR, ask your questions, and you'll get feedback and help that way, which really is, you know, a great way to learn because they're expert Rust developers. And, you know, the same goes if you're trying to contribute to other large code bases. The people who maintain it, you know, are typically really great at that language and great people to learn from. Whether or not they actually have the time to help is another question. But if they are willing, it's a great resource. And so opening those draft PRs, asking your questions, you know, trying to figure things out beforehand, I think is pretty valuable.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I learned Rust also. I wanted to make more contributions to Foundry. It was a pretty big code base. And so, you know, I spent some time reading the Rust book, reading the Foundry code base, opening PRs and just asking questions when I got stuck. And they were all super helpful and supportive.
And what really made you want to do that, though? Obviously, there's no monetary incentive. It's more about like improving the ecosystem, right? So,
yeah, just I'd say just because I find it fun and like interesting. I've been writing Solidity for a couple of years. I first started doing it in like 2017, 2018 on the side, and it's incredible how far the tooling has come. Everything that you do in Forge was like 100 times harder back then. And so, yeah, it's like wild how far things have come. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So I think that might be part of it too, is like, mm-hmm. Wow, we've come this far. It's cool to be a part of that and help out. And so, yeah, there's no financial incentive. I do it in my free time when I'm not, you know, doing work at Scopelift. But mm-hmm. It's definitely learned a lot. You meet a lot of great people that way too. And it's been fun.
Yeah, for sure. And let's diverge a bit to Scopelift. So what is this and why did you kind of start building this? Or
you're asking about Scopelift specifically now?
Yeah.
Got it. So yeah, Ben started Scopelift a while ago. Like okay. It used to, he started it, I don't know what year, but it used to just be like an iOS development shop, I believe. And eventually he got into crypto, wanted to pivot Scopelift into just being like a crypto dev shop instead of an iOS dev shop. And I think that transition for him was around like 2019 or 2020, which is when we first linked up. So that was kind of the inception he was running this dev shop, wanted to transition it to crypto. We linked up. I have been working on stuff since. It's been pretty fun because we get to work with a lot of really great teams in a variety of different ways. So we've worked with Optimism, kind of helping. When Uniswap V3 came out, yeah. Optimism was still on the OVM. So they weren't EVM equivalent yet. And so they had their own compiler, which bloated the code. And so we worked with them to help make changes to both Optimism and Uni V3 to port things to the OVM, which was really fun. We've gotten to work with Uniswap on this seatbelt tool, which is like a governance safety tool. Gitcoin, we've done a lot of work with them on their grants checkouts for Gitcoin grants. And so it's just been fun getting to like be involved in all different parts of the ecosystem at all different layers of the stack.
Mm. And you're a director of engineer there as well. So a director of engineering.
Yes.
How is that different to normal engineering and how does it really change what your day-to-day is like? Obviously you're choosing or telling your engineers what to do, right? So in that sense, there's also, how do you prioritize again? Which seems to be, you know, a reoccurring factor. So how do you really manage that?
So I would say what I do is kind of less of like telling people what to do at an individual level and more of like, once you get stuck or like trying to figure out, you know, where we should go, certain directions, not the best phrasing. Let me back that one up for a sec. Yeah. So typically like we'll have a bunch of clients and we'll have some of our own internal projects and a lot of the client work, there'll be, you know, one or two people assigned to kind of lead that work. And so as director of engineering, I'll also have some clients or internal projects that I'll help lead, but I'll also try to like just stay on top of all the projects and help out where I'm needed and just kind of help out as needed for all these different projects. It's definitely, you know, I guess we probably have, I don't know, half a dozen things going on at any given time. And we're a small team. I think there's six of us. So it would be too much to like be fully involved with all of them. And so I'll lead like one or two projects or, you know, it varies at any given time. And, you know, other projects will have different sub projects within them. So like Umbra, for example, we is our stealth address protocol for like private payments. There's a couple different threads going on there between like maintenance of the current version. We're also working on an ERC and, you know, we'll have some people work on the maintenance of the current version and I'll focus on the upcoming EIP that we're working on. So it's kind of just staying involved with all the different threads, helping out, providing assistance, make sure people don't get blocked, all that kind of stuff.
I guess when someone gets blocked and they don't really know what to do, they just come to you for help or they just ask the team. But maybe there's like a workaround, and I guess you always got to compromise when you get stuck at some to some degree if you can't do the original plan, right? So
right.
Let's say you did get stuck on something that's, you know, blocking you, because this has happened, you know, every engineer, for me, it's happened almost every day. But it's like, you know, some of them can be like a massive delay if it's like a core infrastructure problem. And then you have to
right.
change that. And if you change the foundation to the house, kind of the whole house has to, it looks differently, right? Or mm-hmm. some compromise in some way. So I guess if you do come across one of these like really big problems of core infrastructure, how do you really go about deciding what's the next best step? And even though it might change the future of the development in some different way, how do you assess the trade-offs for one decision over another?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on the nature of the issue. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, some types of issues might be things like, oh, there's a bug in Forge or a missing feature, and so we can't do X. And so your options are either work around it or, you know, put a PR into Forge and try to get it fixed yourself in the next day or two, and then you can be unblocked. Mm-hmm. Other times you might be writing some smart contract code and, you know, you're pretty late in development and you want to add a feature, but there's not really a great way to fit that into your current architecture. And so then it kind of comes down to the client, whether, you know, it's an internal project and we're the client or it's an external client. How much funding do we have? What's the timeline? How important is the feature? How much work would it be to restructure and rewrite our tests if we have to? And really just kind of have to handle it on a case-by-case basis and figure out what the best approach is. And it kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, which is like, well, maybe there's some way we can shrink this feature to fit it into the current architecture and, you know, like 80-20 kind of thing, get most of the same benefits, but avoid the rework and the rewrites.
And what is your kind of like go-to strategy for, you know, when you think of an idea of something to implement, do you draw up something on like a piece of paper and work on that for a few weeks and then start implementing it? Or is it really like kind of simultaneous? Okay, this needs to be added. Let's add this. Oh, okay, now we have to add this. Let's build this.
Not really much paper here. Usually I'll just either try to, I think basically just trying to start writing code helps me think a lot. And a lot of times I'll try to do some thinking up front over what the architecture should look like. And sometimes it comes out pretty good and you stick with it and that works. Other times, once you start actually writing code, it can also find holes in my thinking. And so you might end up changing the architecture because you start writing something and you realize you have this weird coupling or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you want to change things. And so it's kind of interesting because like in aerospace, it was very waterfall, you know, here's your requirements and just figure out how to make it work. And so even though in crypto, it's not move fast and break things, I still feel like the iterative process of writing some code, seeing what didn't work, changing the architecture as a result does help. Although it can also be time consuming because you write something and now you have to scrap it all. So I don't like to rely on that approach and still just kind of try to write up some thoughts on architectures beforehand. Not in like a formal way, just in like a, this helps me think kind of way.
Yeah, like decision tree kind of thing, like pseudocode kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've done both approaches. I used to just do like simultaneous. So if I have this grand idea and then, okay, how do we sub-modulize this? And then build one by one simultaneously while thinking, how should I build it out? But eventually I hit some, this has to do with like a complex system, but eventually I would hit like some roadblock. And since it's such a core fundamental piece of like software and other things rely on it, if I messed that up, everything else wouldn't really work. And it got to a point where I finished writing it and I realized at the end that I needed something else that I couldn't integrate super easily into it. It was just very painful to go back and redo it. Although it was very fast and very efficient, it's more of like interfacing with the real world and understanding what is possible and then realizing from that. It's kind of like getting punched in the face. And then you know what to do next. Don't get punched in the face by, you know, moving left.
Yeah.
So it was very good as in like trial and error, which I still like to do now. And I've kind of defaulted back to it in some way. But I also think writing out just a draft pseudo architecture beforehand and what can possibly go wrong is like drawing a decision tree and kind of accounting for every possibility or, you know, majority that you think at the time, because obviously you don't know what you don't know. It definitely is
right.
A great help, but the trial and error strategy for me works tremendously.
Yeah. And what you said reminded me too of another point, which I think is kind of important, which is like your interfaces, whether it's, you know, your inter-contract interfaces for how they communicate or how the public's going to interface and your users are going to interface with your contracts. That's kind of one part where I've noticed when you change your interfaces, it can be really tedious because it just propagates and touches, you know, not just your source code, but now all of your tests usually have to be updated too. And so that's something that I like to focus on a little more during this like upfront stage is try to think of what the interfaces will look like, just because getting those right is a big time saver and a pretty important part.
Yeah, I agree. If the interfaces are, you know, always constantly changing, no one's ever going to use it. And even just for like upgrading and scaling, it just becomes this whole game of going back, trying to understand the system. And then, you know, like reiterating after that, I think for me personally, I jump through like project to project or like multiple repos at one time, maybe like three different code bases. And maybe I spend like a couple of days away from something and I kind of forget where I was at and then you have to relearn it all. So if it's not the same the whole time, I guess it is quite painful. And then even then you have to document everything as well. So I guess what's your go-to strategy for documenting? Something that I've personally done is starting to write why this function exists as opposed to what this function does. So I write like inline comments within the function of what it does to kind of like help my future self understand when I come back to it. But then I ask the question like, why is this even here? So
that's interesting. I haven't tried that, but that sounds pretty interesting. Cause yeah, typically what I'll do is focus on the what, which I think is probably what most people do. Like, what does this function do? And then I think the times where I will write the whys is when you get to parts of code that look weird or suspicious or confusing for whatever reason. Maybe you had to drop down into assembly, or maybe in your test you had to do a, you know, FFI call to an external script. Things like that is where anything that seems atypical is often where I'll have the whys.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, a lot of times recently I've been trying to be pretty good about nat spec comments, because ForgeDoc gives you a pretty nice output for free, which is pretty helpful for just getting API documentation for your contracts. But yeah, I'll have to start thinking about a little more as I write the nat spec comments for functions.
Yeah, it's a really great help, especially when you're building, you know, it's some really large code base and very complex one that has multiple moving parts at the same time.
Yeah.
You want to know, you know, for me personally, I do like diagram kind of pseudocode where, okay, if this happens, we do this. If this other thing happens, we do this.
Yeah.
That's how I can kind of like put that diagram representation into code is like, okay, why do we use this? Because this needs to be called before this to even work, or, you know, it's a dependency of this. And then from there, you can kind of structure it in a way where it's also like a diagram visual representation. If you just take out the whys of each function, you can kind of connect them like that.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of becomes like a to-do list in some sense, and clarifies your thinking of, you know, what's the function meant to be doing or should be doing. I think it has that like as maybe like indirectly. Yeah,
I like that. And I also think it's interesting because I think it kind of depends on like who you're trying to write your docs and comments for. Because what you're gonna write in your code comments for someone new to the protocol is different than what you're gonna write in your code comments for your team and who understands it well. Yep. And so a lot of times I try to think too, like, okay, what would the auditors want to know here? Right? Like that I think is the kind of most important audience, like someone new to the code base who's trying to understand it. And helping them on board as easy as they can. And typically that ends up being auditors, you know, or new team members. But that's where like a lot of the implicit assumptions you have about how things will work and what things are intended to do kind of surface, because they're not going to have those assumptions because they haven't been, you know, working with you for the last couple of months.
Yeah.
And so you have to make sure to be explicit there.
Yeah, you're paying for that time as well, and even like it's yourself over time cost as well. Like if there's not good documentation, you have to spend time reading and trying to understand, get that context, which I don't know, for me takes like 30 minutes or some time if I'm in like a flow state, then that's kind of like a hindrance. But the faster I can get into the state where I know the overall context, jumping from project to project, and the faster I can start actually working into the flow state, into an iterate. For these complex systems, another like important thing is testing. So how do you really write tests for these in a scalable way?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about testing a lot recently. A lot of times, audits or other people will find bugs and you realize like, oh, this should have been caught by a simple test. Even for like deployments too, there's been bugs because people forgot to initialize their proxy contracts. And it's like, well, that could have, you could have had a simple test on your deploy script. And so I've been thinking a lot about testing. And so recently we came out with this tool called Scope. Yeah. And one of the commands it has is scopelint spec. And it's kind of the first version right now. And so it's kind of naive. The way it works is if you structure your tests in a certain way, it'll kind of spit out like a human or developer friendly spec. And so, for example, the ERC20 token, you have a transfer method and it should revert in these cases. It should succeed with certain state changes in other cases.
Yeah.
And if you have your test architecture structured in the way that this tool needs, you can run scopelint spec and it'll say, here's all of your test cases for the transfer method. And here's all of your test cases for the approved method. And so that's kind of nice from like a high level. So you can take a step back and review what you were saying earlier, like the whys of each method. Like, why do we have this method? Is it doing what it's supposed to? And are we testing all of the edge cases that could present? Like, for example, if you transfer to yourself, do you have a test for that would show up in the output? It might be kind of hard to find just reading through the code. And so we've been trying to like get better at making sure tests, and this gets harder to do as your code base gets bigger just because there's a lot to cover. And so we've been trying to be careful about making sure we are explicit about all of the things you're testing, both like core functionality and edge cases. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a couple other people like Paul Berg, his Sablier, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. They just came out with Sablier V2. I was talking with him a lot too, because he was kind of asking wondering the same thing, which is like, how can we write our tests as best as possible? So he has another technique that he uses. We might try to like unify them. We're working with a couple of people to try to figure out what's the best approach to kind of have, a light spec, right? If you go too heavy with your spec, like formal verification, it's just too costly. And most devs are, and most companies or protocols aren't going to have the time and money to like learn how to write formal specs and test them. We want to try to find like this middle ground where developers can write approachable and like understandable specs and have it mapped to your tests to make sure you have tests for all these different scenarios.
Yeah, I agree. I think, testing is such a difficult thing to do. Well, especially with like large code bases, and then you have different actors as well, different contexts in which a function is important, right? And I think the only real solution to do that is to fuzz with different actors. But even then, you've got to direct it somehow. And I know Foundry has a fuzzer, but it's what we call like a dumb fuzzer right now. But I think you guys are adding, mutation-based fuzzing and symbolic execution. So that'll be interesting.
The Foundry fuzzer is pretty good. I definitely wouldn't call it a dumb fuzzer. I mean, there's a various degrees of fuzzing, right? Like you have black box fuzzing, gray box, and white box. And so like Echidna, for example, I think it would be gray box because it has like a coverage guidance feature. Whether or not most people actually use that, I'm not sure. Forge kind of takes a different technique. So it's not just generating random values, which would be kind of useless, but it has a couple of different strategies. So it'll try to generate edge case values, right? So if you're passing in a uint as a fuzz input, it'll make sure you take 0, 1, 2, 3 and like max uint and then max uint minus 1, 2, 3. Same for any other types. It'll also like collect all the push values and like S stores in your bytecode, or pushes in your bytecode, and then the S loads and stores during execution, add those to a dictionary and, randomly use those values sometimes. That way, when you have conditionals, you're more likely to hit them because really show up as push bytes. And so there's all these different various strategies. And invariant testing in Forge, which I'm trying to move towards calling it like stateful fuzz to be more precise, because you can test invariants with, you know, the plain fuzz tests that it has too. But yeah, like having these stateful fuzz tests is super important, and something that I think people are a lot more aware of and being sure to include these days. A lot of times when you're building a protocol, you have like a high level idea of what you want and what it's supposed to do, but you're not getting an itemized spec. And so there's a lot of implicit assumptions. And so trying to think of these invariants that either, you know, should be globally true or only true in certain states, and then having well-written tests for them, like you were saying, with different actors or different tokens or whatever, is really important.
Yeah, I think Foundry has, you know, a leg up compared to standalone fuzzes, because it is a tool testing suite and you can specify your invariants. And it's very easy to do this, right? Because you already have the context of your contract, your whole code base, and you can write invariants and then run it through this fuzzer. That's the major edge of this, I think. But the other techniques aren't really too good in terms of optimizing for, you know, time complexity issues. It's still going to take super long compared to something, you know, that's doing static analysis and kind of formulating the correct paths and what's actually possible and all that stuff. Yeah, I think one thing I think that Foundry is missing, which I think is like a massive like gap, is there's no inline invariance. So let's say you have your contract in Forge, right? Or in Foundry, and you want to write an invariant. You can only do it at the end of a function or before a function, right? So I think something like inline within a function body would like greatly improve, you know, something like a fuzzer.
Are you kind of suggesting like in what you're looking for is in your source contract, in the middle of a function, you might have some assertion that should always be true at that time?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that's interesting. I guess there's kind of two thoughts there. One is like, in that case, maybe it should be split into two functions, and that way you can test the state at the end of a certain function. And the reason that's nice is because one approach you can use for testing is basically write a harness for your source contract that adds assertions before and after execution of methods. So you might have like an internal transfer method, and instead of running your invariant tests against your source contract, you can have like, you know, a token harness that inherits from it and adds any kind of logic you want before or after. You don't often need to do that because a lot of people will use this like handler pattern, which is really well documented in the Foundry book. But basically having these handler contracts kind of lets you get a lot of the same benefit, so that you can't do it in the middle of the function, but you can put things before and after. And there's all sorts of techniques there, like ghost variables, for example, right? So you want to make sure the sum of your balances is equal to your total supply. You're not going to track that on chain because that would be really expensive and you can't iterate over your mapping keys, but you can iterate over your mapping keys in Forge. You could either track them manually, or I think just earlier, maybe today even, a new cheat code was added to let you get access to keys and mappings. I have to double check. It was something around mapping keys. But either way, there are a lot of techniques to do similar things to the inline asserts, but not exactly. And if you really do need the inline asserts, you can always put them in. And I think the SMT solver that Solidity has, I don't have too much experience with it, but I think it could help there to make sure, to help you formally verify that those, you know, assertions will always hold.
Yeah, I don't really mean like deploying on chain with the asserts, but more just like,
right.
Yeah.
I know Hardhat used to have a plugin that would strip all of your asserts out before deploy. Someone could write a similar thing for Forge, and that should, and you know, you could definitely do that.
So with that, you would easily be able to identify where specifically an invariant's breaking within it, instead of like at the end of a function.
Right. Although I will say, most of the times the invariants, I'd be curious if you have an example that contradicts this, but I think most invariants that you care about are like pre and post states. Right. So like, for example, like Uniswap XY equals K, you don't really care what happens in the middle of the transaction, as long as by the time it's done, all of your state is consistent and following the invariants.
Right. I think for contracts that kind of depend on external things as well, though, for example, you could easily check a reentrancy vulnerability by saying, is this state actually updated before, before the external call? You can't really do that at the end of a macro function. It's more of like what's happening line by line.
That's true. One way you could do that is there are forged cheat codes to record storage writes. There isn't one that would, you might be able to hack something together where you basically start recording all the storage writes, and then after your call, make sure the order of operations there matches what you expect. I don't think there's like a record calls cheat, but that could be a good idea to help accomplish something like that. And basically just something to give you introspection into the internals of that execution. And that way you can inspect it after and make sure it having the control flow that you expect.
Yeah. On the topic of invariants, I always wonder what people think about the automation of them, especially in business logic. I know it's a very, hard question to answer, but just off the top of your mind, first thoughts, if you were to create something that automates basically invariant discovery, what would you really do? I think it's actually not that difficult to begin with. What I personally would do was just see what is actually true in this function or control flow. And then through that list of what's actually true, you can kind of see whether that matches your intended topic or your intended, I guess, flow or execution.
So by invariant discovery, do you just mean like figuring out what your system invariants are, or do you mean figuring out if they actually hold? I think you mean the former.
Yeah, the former. Because like the main thing you see, and the reason why people don't really use these automated tools, is because you have to write in a a specific domain language, right? To write what's meant to uphold. And nobody really wants to do that. They want to just have it all automatic. They don't want to spend the time learning these languages so they can actually use a tool. They just want to use a tool. It's like a massive UX downfall of all the current tools. It's just too hard to set up and use. Yeah, automating would be like the main thing. So I wonder how, in your first thoughts, how would you think this would work in an abstract level?
So I don't think automating discovery of invariants is going to be too practical, largely because it's almost like a product question, like a design question. What am I intending my system to do? And maybe there's a reason why you don't need the sum of balances to equal the total supply, because you're, doing some funky token. I don't know why, but things like that, especially as systems get more complex too, it's like, you don't really know what's intended behavior and what's accidental based on the current system design. And So I'm skeptical that like you'll ever be able to automate finding them. I think you might be, in theory, you could probably automate like finding properties that are true. I think it would be hard, but whether or not those properties are intended is a different question. Like maybe you didn't intend this invariant to exist because it restricts some type of action or something. And so I think you'll always have to do, some just manual thinking and discussing with your team of like, what are the invariants that should always be true, both from the protocol wide level and like the individual function level. And to your point, like there is no like easy way to do that and write them and test them. It's a little time consuming right now, but it's definitely worth the time investment because of, the security gains that you get and just the understanding of your end system.
I agree. I mean, like all these macro kind of systems, automating this kind of stuff is incredibly difficult when you're trying to make it sophisticated. And I think that brings me to a point of asking a question of what is actually missing in the space in terms of security. Obviously, the holy grail would be to have something find every exploit ever. I think as a next step, what do you think is missing?
I think there's a lot of really good tools right now. Like we've talked about fuzzing tools, there's Foundry, there's Echidna, there's Harvey. There's also a lot of symbolic execution tools. You have, K by runtime verification and Halmos and HEVM and EPMC. And then there's also a bunch of mutation testing tools. Certora has Gambit and Trail of Bits has Nut or something like that. And there's a couple of others. There's all these really great tools, but it's very fragmented. And there's not really many repos that are using them all, either using all types of testing or having them integrated into their pipelines or using different ones for certain things. And so I think kind of figuring out when to use each tool, where to fit them into your like developer workflow, and like just more broadly get them in into standard workflows would be really powerful. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're still tools. Like, you have to use them correctly. You can't just throw them in there, not think about it, and be good. Yeah. You know, you have to make sure you're carefully writing your invariant tests. Not symbolic execution is hard. You can't just symbolically execute all of your tests on a big protocol. It'll, you know, probably time out. And so being deliberate about which parts of your code base you symbolically execute, where does mutation testing make sense here? Like if I'm going to have to mutate Solidity and recompile, well, now my CI is going to be really slow because I have to recompile my code base thousands of times. And so figuring out how to scope your mutation testing and stuff, I think they're all things that haven't been like super widely explored and documented. And so trying to figure out how to unify all of these and put out guidance of like when to use each one and how, I think would be really valuable.
Yeah, I think another major flaw is also marketing with these tools as well. I think a lot of the benchmarks are kind of false or aren't really comprehensive. It's all based on like a set database of... We find this much money and this many vulnerabilities, but it's not explaining what are the vulnerabilities, how complex are they, and, you know, what are you actually attacking? And any tools really display the efficiency correctly, and it doesn't really help the user, doesn't convince the user to really use it.
Yeah, benchmarks are a great point too. Like, benchmarks are hard, and right, for the exact reason you mentioned, is you want to make sure they're realistic. So for example, like a lot of times you'll see fuzzing benchmarks that just have a lot of if statements. If x is greater than y, and if y plus x is less than 100, but like no one really has Solidity code like that with just a bunch of nested if statements with random integer conditions. And so, you know, it's nice if your fuzzer can handle it, but just because your fuzzer can't handle it doesn't mean it's worse than one that can. And so finding good benchmarks for all of these tools is hard. And yeah, I don't have a great answer there. I think from like the developer's perspective, the answer is probably just going to be try all the tools, because some will work for your code base and some won't. They all have different trade-offs, you know, Bound and Echidna and Harvey all have different trade-offs, and all the symbolic execution tools have different trade-offs, and same with mutation testing. And so which is the right set of trade-offs for you? There probably will never be like a one-size-fits-all answer. And so it's, you know, maybe it doesn't matter too much what the cross benchmarks say if a certain tool is a better fit for your architecture.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
I still think benchmarks are important, to be clear.
Yeah, I guess the best way to benchmark would really be to just, you know, use all the tools on the same code bases and make the code bases, you know, advanced, you know, simple to advanced, right? And in multiple different kind of a variety of vulnerable contracts. For example, like it's kind of like a CTF, really. Like it's easy to hard, but I guess you have multiple on each kind of severity. So I guess you could cover everything, really, where it goes from, you know, Oracle manipulation to reentrancy to read-only reentrancy, combination of multiple, you know, flash learn, reentrancy, right. Oracle manipulation, just get like advanced, more advanced as you keep going. And then also kind of fill in the complexity of the code base as well. So are you using structs, dynamic arrays, mappings with nested dynamic arrays, something like that. And then I think if you run every tool on this like subset of contracts with varying degrees of difficulty, but, you know, multiple selections of them in each difficulty, then you could have a great benchmark. Otherwise, everybody's just doing benchmarks of, you know, a set database of, I mean, where are they getting the contracts? Like, they could be creating their own where, you know, their one is designed for it. So it's kind of artificially boosting the...
Yeah, there's been a couple of benchmarks for fuzzers. I think Consensus put out one called Daedalus. And there's another one that someone presented at ETH, I think, that compared... I think both of them compared, you know, Harvey, Foundry, and Echidna. And I like the direction you're going of like, take real world exploits and, you know, see if your fuzzer can catch them. the Echidna README has a trophies section of like, hey, here's all the, you know, bugs we've found in like real contracts, which I think is pretty neat. And I think something like that would be a good starting point for a benchmark to see, you know, if Forge and Harvey can find them. And even then you have to be careful too, because like, you're not just telling the fuzzer, here's the code, find bugs. Like, you still have to construct your tests and set things up. And if you set up your benchmark to like guide one fuzzer a lot more narrowly than the other, it might look better, but it's just an artifact of your benchmark architecture. And so you still definitely have to be careful with how they're configured, but I think it's definitely a good starting point.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of the more automated route, but nobody does the fully automated route actually. So yeah, I guess it is actually way more artificially boosted than what I previously thought, because I mean, it really comes down to if it's also manipulated by, you know, the operator, then it's also relying on the operator's skill to create something that directs it
right
a better way. So maybe it's not better, it's just the operator using one tool than another.
Right, exactly. And if you try to go the fully automated route, the way you could do it is say, you know, here's the entire interface for my protocol, and not put any bounds on the generated inputs and just let it go. But you're going to get so many useless runs that way that it'll just probably take a long time and just use, right? Like if it ever finds anything. And so finding like the sweet spot is kind of tough.
Yeah. The whole point of really building a fuzzer is to make it smart and think of techniques to reduce these redundant, runs. So yeah, we'll see how it all plays out. I'm quite keen, especially when ZK comes out. I'm sure a lot of people are going to try and, you know, jump on the boat. I mean, people are already running ZK fuzzers, but it'll be good to see how AI plays as well in this field.
I'm curious to see how it unfolds. It's a little too early to be useful, but it changes quick.
And not just ChatGPT. I know everybody's using that right now for their program analysis projects, but
I don't think I would trust it right now.
Please find bug in my contracts.
Yeah, I wish it was that easy. That would be nice.
I'm sure it'll happen in the future, but maybe not anytime soon.
Yeah, we'll have to see. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really great tools out there, and they're getting better quick. So it's really nice that developers have access to all this these days.
For sure. We have hit an hour, though. I would like to thank you for coming on and spending time with me, having a conversation. First time meeting you as well. So really grateful that we could spend this hour together. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Yeah, it was fun talking with you. Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Of course. And I'm sure the audience would also enjoy this talk. But if you would like someone to come on this podcast, or if you would like to come on yourself, please DM me on Twitter at @scrapingbits, and I'll hopefully get back to you. Otherwise, thank you, Matt, for coming on, and I'll see you all in the next episode.